Yeah. All right, before we get to the fun facts, I gotta go
Okay.
pee real quick.
Okay. So yeah, this is so that you know what the song is. So damn tough, I don't know where I can go. They let me get out of my skull. My grandma passed, my brother's gone. I never felt like I'm so alone. I know you're supposed to be steering wheel, not just my spare tire. Lord, I ask you to be my guiding force and truth. Some strange vision had to be. He guided me to Tennessee. So take me to another place. Take me to another land. Make me forget all the hurt. Me understand your plan.
What were you listening to?
Just rocking out, waiting for you.
Welcome, everybody, to State of Murder, and I believe this is episode 28? I think we're on episode 28.
Yeah, I think you're right. Episode 28. I was just talking to my dad about it.
Nice. I know. I talked to, actually, so speaking of talking to family members about the podcast, I talked to my cousins about it, and my brother was like, yeah, you guys have been very consistent with it. I'm like, yeah, weekly, like, we put the stuff out, because I think a lot of podcasts kind of stopped or took at least a break or two because of COVID and trying to figure everything out, but we had just started, so we wanted to
I know. We were, like, so excited and gung-ho for this podcast. We were like, COVID, whatever, we're not stopping. I think if it happened right now, we might take a couple week break, but, I mean, we're already in the, you know, in the swing of things. So we're good.
Yeah, so definitely. But he was like, yeah, my family doesn't listen to the podcast as frequently. They said they've all listened to most episodes or some episodes, but my brother's reasoning was that he listens to podcasts in the car, and now that he doesn't go anywhere, which definitely has been, there's only been like one or two podcasts that I've really stuck consistently with, because like him, that was my drive time thing, is like going to work and coming home or going to places for work. It was podcast time. So
yeah, I'm with you on that. So I am so behind on almost all of my murder podcasts. The only one I am up to date with is True Crime Obsessed. So yeah, and I'm same. And I'm up to date with that one and the Patreon on that one. Other than that, no, I'm months behind on everything else.
Yeah, same here. So thank you to all of our listeners who stuck with us, even though we're in COVID times. We appreciate you. Thank you for listening, because today, as of the recording of this podcast, we hit 2,000 listens, you guys. So Woo! Thank you.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
It took us, let's see, March, April, May, June, July. It took us 5 months to get 1,000, and it's only taken us like 1.5, 2 months to get to 2,000. So that's awesome. Thank you guys so much for tuning in.
We're growing. I mean, we've had opportunities where we've been able to go on to other podcasts and other live shows. And so I think that that's gotten us some exposure. And also, I'm just going to be honest, I think we've gotten better over the last 6 months or so. So like our first podcast, like I felt like I was struggling. I didn't know what I was doing. I was super uncomfortable. And now I feel like, okay, no, I'm getting more into the feel and I feel more at ease. And so I'm like, okay, yeah, I can handle this.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, so we're pretty excited about that. That means more people are listening and tuning in regularly. So, thanks. Yeah, so like I said, we're in Tennessee this week.
I know.
I don't know what Tennessee is.
Volunteer state.
Volunteer? Like,
It was named the Tennessee, the University of Tennessee, they're known as the Volunteers. It's the Volunteer State. It was named after that because a huge faction went down to New Orleans in the War of 1812 and volunteered to fight in the War of 1812. And so they became known as the Volunteer State.
Huh.
Oh, super fun state fact at the beginning.
Yeah, you get a bonus state fact. I would have thought it would have something to do with country music, just because Nashville is like huge with country music.
That is
right?
True. Yeah, but nope. So the Volunteer State it is. Although every time I hear the name Tennessee, I think of the Arrested Development song. I don't know if you know who Arrested Development
I've seen
is.
It. I don't know what song so
it's
you're
like,
talking about.
Not, no, it's not a TV, not the TV show. It's Arrested Development is kind of a, not hip, I don't know what to consider it, hip hop maybe, group from the 90s.
Oh.
So,
yeah,
they
I don't
sing,
know
that. It's like, Tennessee, Lord, I really dig this land. Like, and then it goes on. So I guess it's like a little hip hop rap. I'm not going to sing it all. So every time I hear the state Tennessee, that's the song that goes on in my head is from Arrested Development. So
nice. Okay. All right. Well, on that note, let's get into the cases. What do you got for us this week?
All right. So this week, I know in our last podcast, we were in Alabama. And so at the end of it, we were talking about Elvis and my love of country music, and well, Elvis isn't really country, but he is, like, he's from his he lived in Memphis, Tennessee. But anyway, I do also have a love for country music, and so I thought I would try to find a country music murder. So I did, and so this is a country music murder that sort of rocked all of Nashville in the 1970s. And it actually kind of changed how country music stars lived their lives and viewed their safety. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. So David Aikman was born on June 17th, 1916. And he actually grew up in Annville, Kentucky. I don't know why I said Kentucky that way. That's really weird.
Sorry, Kentucky.
Sorry. I just all of a sudden got a weird accent there. So he came from a musical family, and he learned how to play the banjo from his dad. There were two stories, actually, that I found on how he came to own his very own first banjo at the age of 12. So first story was that he and his best friend built their banjo and, like, kind of shared a banjo together. But most people believe that he actually traded a pair of prize-winning bantam chickens. So that's, I guess, a kind of chicken. I don't know.
It's like a special kind of chicken.
I think they're like show chickens, because you have you ever seen, oh, there's like a documentary about people who show chickens, and it's hilarious. If you I can't think of the name of it, but if I do, I'll put it in our blog. I'll find it and I'll put it in our blog. It is the greatest documentary. So anyway, so you'll find out about
to check it
chickens
out.
It's hilarious. These people are hilarious. So either way, at the age of 12, he had his first banjo, and he was on his way to being a musician. So he actually started playing for local dances, but that wasn't making him a lot of money. So he ended up joining the, because this was in the Depression era, so mm-hmm. he joined the Civilian Corps, which, if you don't know what the Civilian Corps was, it was created in response to the Great Depression by FDR. And it helped unemployed men go back to work. And so a lot of times they would build roads and do kind of like menial tasks. But it's how a lot of our highways and interstates got built in the 1930s is that this was a way that the government could support people during the Great Depression. So David took a job doing this, and he ended up building roads and planting trees. So, however, David didn't want to just do that. He wanted to do something with his music. So he actually ended up entering a talent competition, which was judged by Asa Martin, who was apparently a well-known guitar player in the area in the 1930s. David ended up winning the competition and was invited by Asa to join his band. So one night while they were playing on stage, Asa went to introduce David, but couldn't remember his name. And so instead, he called him String Bean. So he was like, String Bean, come on over here and play that banjo. And so the name String Bean stuck. David was really tall and lanky, so like kind of like a string bean. And so for the rest of the story, I'm going to refer to him as String Bean because that's what everybody else called him.
Okay.
Sometimes one of his best friends always called him String, because I guess shortened version, but String Bean it's gonna be, which is so freaking country. I love it. There's gonna be some more. There's some very country things coming up. Now, String Bean didn't just play in Ace's band. He also, at one point, was a semi-professional baseball player, and he ended up creating a musical comedy duo called String Beans and Cousin Wilbur.
Oh my God. Also, really, like baseball and music and like it's just jumping around
I
here.
know he was a man of he had many talents. So String Beans and Cousin Wilbur, I'm guessing the Cousin Wilbur was with Willie Egbert Westbrook, and they ended up opening for bluegrass pioneer Bill Monroe. So I'm giving you guys some names because maybe some listeners are super country music fans. I'm not going to go into detail of all of String Bean's friends because he was like in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s. He was pretty big in the country music genre. And that is definitely not the country music era that I listen to. So I am a 90s country girl. Like that is my wheelhouse. So that's also my wheelhouse in any music. So like if obviously I was just singing Arrested Development, which is a very 90s band. So, but if you really are into that time period, Ken Burns did a great documentary on country music. I did watch most of it. So you can watch that and learn about a whole bunch of country music stars, and most of them that I'm talking about would be mentioned in that. Anyway, from 1942 to 1945, he ended up opening for Monroe until he was replaced by Earl Scruggs, who was actually somebody in country music I had actually heard of. So
Oh, I was gonna say that name sounds
yeah, he's
familiar.
really big. So he played band he was a really good banjo guitar player. In 1945, String Bean met and married Estelle Stanfill. And during that, right after his marriage, he was invited to play at the Grand Ole Opry, which is a huge honor. Now, in case you don't know what the Grand Ole Opry is, it is a weekly country music stage concert that was founded in 1925 and is the longest running radio broadcast in U.S. history. So in 1939, it ended up, the Opry moved to the Ryman Auditorium. And then in the 19, I think, believe 70s, it went to its own building. But the Ryman Auditorium is very historical. And I'll be talking to about the Ryman in my city fact. So, as I said, it was a really big honor in country music to be asked to join the Opry. During this time, he ended up partnering with Grandpa Jones. They not only worked together, they also bought property together and were neighbors near Ridgetop, Tennessee. So String Bean was one of the biggest stars on the Opry stage in the 1950s. He would play his banjo, he would sing, and then he would do comedy on stage. So he created this persona. So if you look up pictures, I'll attach a picture in our blog, but he wore this really funny outfit where he had his shirt would go like to his knees, and then the belt was at his knees, and then he had like these really short pants, so it was very comic. So I guess to look more like a string bean and kind of like long and lean, I don't know. I don't know why the short legs made him look more string beany, but either way, he had this string bean persona, and it was like down to the T. He had chart toppers like Chewing Gum and I Wonder Where Wanda Went.
Oh my goodness.
He ended up recording 7 albums. One of the sweetest stories I read about String Bean was that he had actually never learned how to drive, and so his wife Estelle would drive him to every single one of his shows and wait and then
Aww.
take him back home. So their relationship, everybody talks about their relationship and how they were like obviously meant to be together and they were the perfect couple, and it was just a beautiful loving relationship. So in 1969, String Bean and Grandpa Jones became cast members of a new television show called Hee Haw. So,
Hey, I know that one.
oh,
It
good.
feel
So,
like my mom's mentioned it before, or like they've mentioned something similar to that.
yeah, I asked my mom and dad because they were asking me what murder I was doing, and I was taught, and I said, oh, I'm going to do the String Bean murder. And my mom and dad both knew exactly who that was because of Hee Haw. So that was like probably one of the only TV shows my mom was probably ever allowed to watch. Because TV was very frowned upon in the small town they were from. So if you don't know what Hee Haw is, it was a variety show, kind of like Sonny and Cher, SNL, Laugh-In. However, it featured country music, country comedians, and took place in a fictional rural area called Cornfield Country, which is spelled with K's, which I find just a little bit disturbing. Because, I mean,
Yeah. Anything country related, and a lot of K's kind of makes you think of the KKK.
Right? I'm like, is that? I always thought that with the Kardashians and how they always like have like embraced the K for everything. And I'm like, mm-hmm. ooh, you're walking a fine line with something that's way historically different in meaning. So
yeah.
So I think this as well. So the Cornfield Country did not need to be spelled, and it didn't need to. Why it didn't need to be spelled with K's? It doesn't make sense that it was spelled with K's, because like country music is with a C. Like, mm-hmm. I don't understand the K.
Or did it? Was it a subliminal thing?
That's what I'm saying. I'm like, I don't know. It's so disturbing. I didn't really look into a lot on hee-haw facts because I'm like, okay, we'll just go with that.
I know. And maybe we're getting too into like the races of like, we're seeing the KKK everywhere.
Yeah, I know. Anyways, hee-haw always had women in farmer's daughter outfits, like kind of the stereotypical what you would think a farmer's daughter outfit. Mm-hmm. So I say picture Marianne from Gilligan's Island or Daisy Duke from the Dukes of Hazzard, and that's the kind of country girl that was on hee-haw. Mm-hmm. So String Bean was a regular on the show. He had his like these ongoing routines. He played the scarecrow in like the cornfield. He had this gag where he would have everybody gather around him and he'd talk about how he got a letter from somebody, and then it would be like a joke letter. Anyway, so that's the kind of thing he did on the show. And then he always played his banjo.
Okay.
So during all of this time, String Bean, like many who grew up in the Great Depression, was pretty frugal. He didn't like to spend money. He pretty much always just went hunting and fishing with his friends. Estelle and he owned a very small cabin, and the only thing they ever were known to spend money on was a new Cadillac every year. So every year they bought a brand new Cadillac, paying in cash.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. I was like, cha-ching. Because he did grow up during the Depression, there was a rumor about town that String Bean didn't trust banks and that he kept all of his money that he was making. So like his Opry money, his hee-haw money, all of it was up in his cabin. Although he wasn't like crazy rich, right? Because he wasn't like the biggest country star. He was a banjo player. Mm-hmm. On November 10th, 1973, String Bean was scheduled to play at the Opry like he did most Saturday nights, which was a very well-known fact. It is also known that Estelle always would drive him to the Opry. String Bean was introduced that night, walked onto stage at the Ryman, and opened with a joke about informing a curious ticket holder that he was a part of the show, and the woman's response to that was, "Lord help the other part." So stupid.
Oh my God.
So stupid, their jokes. I love them. So after his set, String Bean, Estelle, Grandpa Jones, and his wife sat backstage and started making plans for the next week. You see, Grandpa Jones and String Bean were going to go away for the week and go hunting in Virginia. Okay. So after they were talking for a little bit, he ended up going and practicing with another Opry singer. And the song that they practiced was "Lord, I'm Coming Home." Nobody knew that this was the last song String Bean would ever sing, and it was sadly poignant because the lyrics were, coming home, never more to roam, open wide thy arms of love, Lord, I'm coming home. So,
oh.
A little foreshadowing.
Isn't that always eerie when things like that happen?
It is. It's so creepy. And yeah, and like when all the Opry people, I'm sure, got together after String Bean's death, they were probably like thinking about it. Oh yeah, just strange.
Yeah.
So the end of the night came and String Bean hopped into the passenger side of his and Estelle's Cadillac. String Bean was wearing a pair of bibbed overalls, which had $3,182 sewn into the inside of the bib, and a .22 caliber pistol in a bag next to him. Estelle had $2,150 tucked into her bra, just something to note. They ended up heading home, and when they pulled up to their little cabin, String Bean noticed that the front door was open. So he grabbed his pistol and headed towards the door while Estelle went around the house and parked the Cadillac. Now I'm going to rewind a little bit to earlier that night. Now, remember that I mentioned String Bean apparently hated banks, and it was rumored mm-hmm. that he kept all the money hidden in his cabin? Well, two cousins, John and Doug Brown, had heard these rumors as well and decided to go rob String Bean's cabin while he was playing at the Opry. They arrived at the cabin and totally ransacked it looking for the money. However, they didn't find any. So, noticing that there wasn't any, they thought, well, maybe String Bean keeps all of this money on his person. So the or the bank.
I guess. Yeah, or maybe that was just a rumor and he has it at the bank.
Yeah. So the two decided to wait for String Bean and Estelle to return home. They even turned on the radio and listened to String Bean singing at the Opry. They were hiding in the house, John Brown wearing a stocking over his head, and his cousin Doug wearing a Halloween mask. I tried to see what kind of Halloween mask, because I, you know, wanted to know, but I couldn't find any specifics. It just said the Halloween mask. When String Bean got to the front door, he apparently hesitated going in, probably looking at the mess that was inside of his cabin. He slowly entered with his gun raised. When he looked to his right, he saw Doug, and he started to shoot. John Brown, who was on his left, had a pistol and ended up shooting String Bean. So String Bean fell down next to the fireplace dead. Now, by this time, Estelle had gotten out of the car and was making her way to the house. When she heard the gunfire, she turned and started running towards the road. However, John quickly caught up with her and ended up shooting her in the back of the head while she was on her knees pleading for her life.
What a douche.
Yeah. Then Doug and John ended up searching both bodies, however, only finding $250 that String Bean had kept in his front pocket of his overalls, and not the over $5,000 that was actually on them. So, stupid.
Wow.
They ended up taking the $250, a couple of guns, Estelle's purse, and a bag of String Bean's, like kind of his, like, I don't know what you'll call it. Costume bag? I don't know. Whatever he carries all of his stuff to and from his gigs. And then also, besides the Cadillac, String Bean and Estelle owned a station wagon that they used for like non-business where they didn't need to look kind of like upscale. Flashy. Yeah, and flashy. So they had this station wagon. And so John and Doug ended up taking that. Estelle and String Bean's bodies were discovered the very next day. As you remember, String Bean and Grandpa Jones were scheduled to leave for a hunting trip that day, and Grandpa Jones drove up around 7 a.m. to pick up String Bean. He became concerned as he drove up the hill and he noticed that there wasn't any smoke coming from the chimney, and it apparently was a pretty cold November morning. When he pulled up, he saw Estelle's body lying next to the hickory tree and String Bean's banjo out on the front porch. He then walked up to the front door and saw his best friend String Bean's body laying next to the fireplace. So, aww. I know. And Grandpa Jones does testify about finding the bodies. And then he also talks about it in some news articles about, like, later on. So, like, in the, like, 90s and 2000s, he talks about it. And he said it took, like, decades for him to ever even open up about this tragedy. It was so hard for him.
Oh, I bet.
So he tried to call the police from the cabin, but the phone lines had been cut. Like, everybody always cuts the phone lines. It's a go-to thing, I guess. So he ended up rushing back down the hill to his house, and then Grandpa returned to the cabin with his wife, and they waited outside. However, they noticed that the radio had been left on in the house, and it was still tuned to WSM, which they then realized that the killers must have been listening to String Bean at the opera right before they killed him. So they were just like, like, just even more like, these fucking dicks.
Yeah.
Because it was obviously planned out. Like, this is a lot of planning then. If you're listening, you know where he's at. You know when he's off. You know when he's coming home. So String Bean and Estelle's murder rocked Nashville in the country music scene. And the hunt for the murderers ensued. Unrelated to this murder, only 2 weeks later, another Opry staple was robbed and murdered in Nashville. And so these, like, never before in country music had there been murders. Like, there'd been deaths and drug overdoses and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But murder was, like, this was totally new for the Nashville scene. And so, as I mentioned, like, when in the opening of this is, like, all of the country music stars, like, started getting security. They started putting gates and locks. And this is in the 70s, and like people didn't even lock their doors. And so now it was like totally different. They started locking their doors. Security became a number one priority. It was obvious to the police that the motive for this had all been about robbery, as the place had been trashed. When they looked at the cabin, they first believed that there were actually three murderers involved based on three different caliber bullets found. But then they realized that one of them came from String Bean, because he actually ended up getting some shots off before, like during the scuffle right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. However, they also found seven bank books that showed String Bean did in fact believe in banks, and all of his money was in a bank. Over $500,000 actually was in a bank in Nashville. It would take a couple of months to track down John and Doug Brown. On January 17th, 1974, four men were arrested, Doug and John for the murders, and Doug's brothers for accessory and concealing stolen property. So and I'm surprised because, here, I'll get to it and then I'll put my point. So the police... Okay. Apparently had the Browns under surveillance for quite some time, but they just didn't have quite enough evidence to go in and search the place and then arrest them. But when they finally got it, that's what they did. On July 23rd, 1974, John and Doug ended up leading police to the final evidence they needed for the case. So they were arrested, but their trial doesn't happen until October of that year, so they were still building up all this evidence. And so the two cousins led them to Greenbrier. There was a pond there, and they had ditched String Bean's costume case there. And so the police were able to locate it. And so that was like really helped them with their open and shut case. So inside of the case was uncashed checks, two recording tapes of String Bean's hee-haw scripts, and String Bean's really cool stage costume. So it was like, obviously, they knew where everything was. It was pretty open shut.
Yeah.
So Doug Brown pled guilty to killing String Bean, however, did not plead guilty to killing Estelle. John Brown, on the other hand, stated that he didn't even remember that night, as he was so whacked out on booze and drugs that he couldn't remember anything at all. The trial for John was pretty swift and quick. His wife actually ended up testifying that he had told her the day after the murders that he had robbed String Bean, and now String Bean and his wife were dead. And when she asked him why he did it, she reported that he stated String Bean came in shooting, so Doug and I killed him, and that's all that he could remember. So, like, obviously he remembered some of the night, and also, excuse me, ma'am, you knew your husband had murdered two people and didn't fucking tell anybody for months. Like,
what the heck?
Oh, man, that pisses me off. So... It only took 3 hours of deliberation for the jury to find John guilty of first-degree murder. Both Doug and John were given two 99-year sentences. So one 99-year sentence for String Bean, one 99-year sentence for Estelle for their murders, to be served consecutively. So they both got a total of 198 years. Doug ended up dying in prison in 2003. However, John Brown was granted parole in 2014 and was released. So the country music community was totally up in arms about this, and a number of people came and spoke at his parole hearing. A lot of Opry people that played alongside String Bean. However, the parole board still granted him his parole, and so he was released after only serving 41 years of his 198-year sentence.
Wow.
I know. It didn't say why they paroled him. I don't know. I think that's kind of bullshit. An interesting note, however, is that in 1998, the new owners of String Bean and Estelle's cabin noticed some loose bricks in the chimney. So when he removed the bricks inside, he found String Bean's hidey hole, and inside was $20,000. Not only did John and Doug miss out on the almost $5,000 or $6,000 on string bean and install, but they also missed out on the $20,000 inside of the house that night.
Wow, he hid his money so good that they ended up staying to kill him. Holy shit.
So that is the story of the murder of String Bean and Estelle Aikman.
Okay, thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Little country music murder.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I wonder if my parents knew who String Bean was. I'll have to ask.
Yeah, so my mom was like, oh yeah, I totally know who that is. And I was like, oh. But he's a pretty funny looking guy. So I'll definitely post a picture of him on the blog and maybe a link to one of his awesome songs.
Nice. Sounds good.
All right. What was your story for this week?
All right. So mine is the story of Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom. This story, just to kind of preface it, I was lucky enough to have found a court case for this, or like the court documentation for it. So the timelines, the way that the court document was outlined and the way some of the articles were outlined, is it flips back and forth because we actually know what happens from the perspective of both like the victim and the perpetrator. So we kind of know two different things happening, and then like the families and the criminal, like we know a lot of stuff. So I'm gonna do things a little different. I'm gonna start with a little bit of backstory on the perpetrators and then some on the victims, and then I'm gonna try to kind of keep it on, like, keep you guys informed as to what time frame I'm switching between, because all of this kind of happened within a weekend.
Okay.
So, and I'm kind of sorry, not sorry, if I mispronounce the criminals' names, because they have very unique names.
Okay.
And, like, I'm sorry because I hate mispronouncing names, but I'm also not sorry because you murdered people.
Yeah, I get it. I get it.
There's that. Also, I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing Shannon's name right, but it's also spelled differently, so I hope I am. If not, I will try to correct it. But her name's spelled C-H-A-N-N-O-N, which I can only pronounce as Shannon. I don't think it's Canon or Channon.
Yeah.
My guess would be Shannon. So okay. I'm going to go with that. So Lamericus Davidson was celebrating the new year with his brother Led Elvis Cobbins in January of 2007. Cobbins had also brought along to celebrate his girlfriend Vanessa Coleman and his friend George Thomas. And they were all staying at Davidson's house. And I'm going to refer to, I know there's four people and like involved in this, but I'm just like I typically do, I'm going to be referring to them by last names. So they were all staying at Davidson's house in Knoxville, Tennessee. And so the brother, I don't know if he was invited or he just brought along like some people and showed up at his house, but suddenly they were there. The brothers had not seen each other in a while due to Davidson being locked up for a carjacking and aggravated robbery. He had served, I believe, 5 years. And so he had just gotten out and his brother came to visit with all these people. And also, too, it's important to note that his brother, so Cobbins, Coleman, and Thomas, none of them had jobs and none of them had money. And they kind of just, that's probably why they also tagged along. So they're just staying at Davidson's house. So at first the four were having a good time. But as the days went on, Davidson became fed up with his brother and friends because they weren't contributing anything. Davidson was struggling to make ends meet himself with his only source of income coming from the drug deals that would take place outside, like in his home. So he was selling stuff. I don't know exactly what he was selling. I think it was marijuana, but I think he might have been selling other things as well. Because I know he was snorting coke and smoking marijuana. Don't know if he was selling the coke or just that was for himself.
That's never good if you're a drug dealer and you're like and you use your own products. Like, never a good combo.
No. Also, I don't know, you think you'd want to be sharp and like on it. And also, if you're struggling to make ends meet, don't be doing drugs when you're like, don't put it all up your nose.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, I mean, if you have an addiction, you can't.
That's true.
That's an illness, so you can't maybe help it, but
that's true.
But still, yes, you're right.
Yes. So Davidson grew angrier and angrier as the days went on, and he took a lot of it out on his girlfriend, Daphne Sutton. So he was beat her up, basically. Didn't go into specifics, but he was beating her pretty bad. So they had already started the process. Like, she had already taken a lot of her stuff out of the house, but this was kind of like she was done. Like,
yeah.
She wasn't going to be the brand. So props to Daphne. You go, girl. So get the hell out of the house.
It's hard to leave a domestic violence relationship. Yes. So a lot of times it takes, isn't the statistic 7 times?
Mm-hmm.
Leaving 7 times.
So definitely. Good job for her. So yeah. She finally left on January 5th, but that only added fuel to the fire inside of Davidson. Which, damn, his brother and friends must have been really irritating. Because it said, like, it didn't say when his brother showed up. My guess was, like, New Year's, or at least a little before New Year's, after New Year's. I don't know. They were only there for, like, less than a week, and he was already, like, done with them.
So, visitors can be trying.
Yeah, I guess. Especially, that's what I'm thinking. Maybe they were unexpected visitors.
Yeah, yeah.
So, tired of things not going his way and ready to change his situation, Davidson came up with a plan. He was going to get his brother and another friend, Eric Boyd, and they would carjack someone. Because remember, he was locked up for that anyway, so that's kind of his thing. Remember last time we were, or the Labor Day episode, we were talking about maybe test a couple things, see where your niche is.
What fits.
Yeah, this is what fits for him. So, okay. David said he didn't care if it meant going back to prison, but, quote, a dude's got to do what a dude's got to do.
I totally get that. I mean, a dude does got to do what a dude's got to do.
Like, I guess. Death. But that also makes me laugh, because I don't know if you've ever watched Rugrats, but that was the Rugrats. That was Tommy Pickles' thing. He's like, a baby's got to do what a baby's got to do. So that's what I think of with that.
I mean, this guy's super edgy. Rugrats edgy. Heck yeah.
I know. So this led them to the Washington Ridge Apartments. The woman who sold Davidson his furniture lived there, and I was trying to understand from the documents and tried to look it up through the articles. I guess he had bought furniture, or maybe she gave him furniture. I don't know. But either way, he was making payments to her. I don't know if it was like she agreed, like kind of like a rent-a-place, like where she was just letting him like pay it off. I don't know.
My dad did that one time when we sold our van in the 90s, and it was on payment plans, and the people only paid one time.
Oh no.
So watch out if you do decide to do that.
Yeah. I also think I can't remember, because she might have been the landlord, or maybe she wasn't. Maybe she just knew the landlord. I can't remember. There were a lot of names in these court documents, and I was trying to keep
everything straight.
It was also unfortunate because some of the last names were like the exact same. And if anyone's ever read a court document, they do like Miss So and So, Mr. So and So, and like over and over. And Daphne, her last name was only like a letter or two different than her friend's last name. And so I was super confused, and I had to keep reading over and over. So anyway, he was supposed to pay this lady. And I can't remember if it was the furniture lady or his landlord. But either way, this lady lived at Washington Ridge. So he was on his way to bring her another payment on Saturday, January 6th, when he spotted a young couple walking to their car. Now I'm going to go back and kind of just shoop, 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 shoop. Because now you know about those guys. And I'm going to tell you about Shannon. So Shannon Christian was born on April 29th, 1985 and I'm for sure going to mispronounce his name, Nacogdoches, Texas? Nacogdoches? I don't know how to pronounce that. The city of Texas.
It does not sound like a big one.
It does not. But I'm trying to... Nacogdoches. I don't know. I try my best. If you're from Texas, let me know how to pronounce it. Although Texas is huge. I don't know.
My friend Lopez is from Texas, and he listens to our podcast. So maybe he'll text me and let me know.
Yeah, if you've ever heard of this city... Because I don't want to just assume that you know every Texas city ever, because I don't know every Californian city ever.
What?
So if you know how to pronounce that.
Yeah, let us know.
Let us know. So she was born there, and she ended up moving to Tennessee in 1997. She was majoring in sociology at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville when she met Christopher Newsom. Christopher was born in Knoxville, Tennessee on September 21st, 1983, and they hit it off right away. Shannon was 21 and Christopher was 23, and they were enjoying a night out on January 6th. plan was to go out to dinner and then head out to a friend's birthday party. In a couple articles I read, they said that they were headed, that they were going to go to dinner, then they were going to watch a movie at their friend's house, and then they were going to go to a party. But in the court document, it was simplified. So I'm going to go with that because that was actual, like, testimony from the people that were there. So they would, I don't know where the movie came in, but that wasn't what I read in the court document. So the plan was to go out to dinner and then head to a friend's birthday party. Shannon got ready at her friend Kara's apartment, and as Kara headed out to the party around 8 p.m., she said she would see her there after dinner. Around 9 p.m., Chris dropped off his friend, Josh Anderson, at the party and said him and Shannon would see them there later. They were just going to go grab a bite to eat. And so Chris headed to pick up Shannon from Kara's apartment, which apparently was only like 10 minutes or so, 15 minutes away from where the party was. After he arrived, they walked across the parking lot to Shannon's Toyota 4Runner, but little did they know that they were being watched. Shannon entered the driver's side, and Christopher took a second to kiss her in the doorway as she sat down. Suddenly, a gun appeared in front of their faces. Boyd and Davidson took control of the car and forced the couple into the back seat. They began to drive to Davidson's house on Chipman Street as Cobbins followed in Boyd's car. When they arrived at the house, they were both bound at the wrists and blindfolded. Before I tell you what happens, though, this is the part where I know something, so we're gonna, like, kind of jump around a little bit because things are happening. It's almost like those movies where things are happening at the same time, and so you kind of flip back and forth.
Yeah.
So it really took me a while to figure out, okay, what's the most effective way to tell you guys all this information? So friends and family members grew concerned as the night went on and there was no sign of Shannon and Chris. Around 10 p.m., friends began to text and call the couple's phones, but got no answer from them. Because at that point, they were like, oh, they were just going to go grab some food and meet us all here, and now we don't know where they're at. Mm-hmm. Around 11 p.m., some friends decided to go searching for them at the apartments, but discovered only Chris's truck was there with no sign of Shannon's 4Runner. Shannon's parents were also worried after not receiving an update from their daughter when she got to the party, since she would pretty much regularly check in with them, like, oh, we're going here. So that way her parents kind of knew where she was. And the original plan was that she was going to spend the night there, like at the party. Like, I guess it was another friend's house, so she was going to stay there. But they didn't get anything from her saying that she had arrived. Chris's parents weren't super concerned because he's 23 and he kind of does this set, like, it just, they were like, oh, he'll check in tomorrow, which is kind of funny because it reminds me of the double standard between me and my brother, because I always had to check in like every single second that I was going somewhere, when I was coming home and like all of that. And Josh never had to text it and check in at all, ever. Yeah. So guys versus girls, I guess. Around 12:30 a.m., however, Shannon's father received a call in which she said she would be returning home around 2 or 3. That was in the court document with no other context as to what happened. So I don't know if it really was Shannon calling, if it was a text message, what was happening. But we'll get into it. Either way, she said she was going to be home around 2 or 3. The next morning, they reached out to Chris's parents after Shannon did not return that night. They quickly called the police to file a missing persons report on the couple. Sunday, January 7th, around midnight, which would be about half an hour before Shannon called her dad.
Okay.
An employee of Waste Connections named Xavier Jenkins would arrive to work at the gated parking lot near Chipman Street. As he waited in his car for his shift to start, he noticed the house across the street to be very active for that time of night. And this was Davidson's house, was right across the street. So this guy just arrived early and he was hanging out. It was like maybe a little bit after midnight or so. He noted that he had never seen Shannon's car out front before, but he did notice the 4Runner was in front of the house, and just, I'm sure he's just very observant as he's waiting to go into work, like what cars are there and not there. He ended up going to a nearby convenience store really quick to grab something. And then when he got back to his car, I think he said close to like 12:50, he saw the 4Runner pull away from the house and head kind of towards his direction. As they were passing him, he remembers seeing four African-American men in the car and that the driver was wearing a black hoodie and kind of like mean mugged him and like gave him a weird look. So that's why he remembers it. He was like, what the heck? Like, he's just walking to his car.
Yeah.
Around 1:45 that morning, a neighbor of Davidson remembers hearing popping sounds that were pretty consistent, like with spacing in between them, coming from the train tracks that were nearby as he was up watching TV. So at 6:30 a.m., when Mr. Jenkins returned to Waste Connections after running his route, he saw that Shannon's car was parked facing the train tracks nearby. He thought it was strange, so he went to look but didn't find anybody inside the car. At 12:20 p.m., so this is all happening on Sunday, all in that morning, J.D. Ford, an employee at Norfolk Southern Railroad, would make a startling discovery. Next to the train tracks, not far from Davison's house, laid Chris's body. He was severely burned and had been shot multiple times. His hands were tied behind his back and his feet were bound together without shoes, so just his bare feet, and he was tied with some sort of like floral fabric. A sock was stuffed in his mouth, a bandana was wrapped around his eyes, and his head was wrapped in a sweatshirt. Which, judging by the fact that they could see the sock and the bandana, my guess is the sweatshirt was just kind of like over the top of his head. Shannon's family was scared and starting to worry that they may never see their daughter again after the discovery of Chris. Because you have to think, like, they were together, and now the chances that you're going to find her alive just shrunk a little.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is another part where I was kind of unclear on the timeline of it because they weren't giving me specific times, but at some point they reached out to law enforcement for help. I don't know if this is initially when they tried to file the missing persons report or if this lines up with after them finding Chris, but either way, law enforcement was like, nope, not gonna help. You guys gotta find her on your own, which seemed weird to me. So that's why I wasn't sure on the timeline, but something tells me it was like after.
Oh, you think it's after? Because why would they say that if they knew a guy she was with was found dead? And then it's like, oh, who gives a shit?
Yeah, I don't know. But based on the next point is why I think it's like that it had to have happened after him. Because they began searching on their own. They found cell records and tried to pinpoint her last location, which led them to, I believe it was called Cherry Street, which isn't anywhere where she was near. I think we had talked about this, like the cell phone towers ping off weird things. So she wasn't anywhere near there, even though the cell tower pinged it.
Yeah.
But as they were just moving street to street to street and continuing the search, on Monday morning around 1 a.m., their search party discovered Shannon's car on the corner of Chipman and Glider Streets. So I'm like, Monday at 1 p.m., like, and they had been searching.
Yeah.
So that had to have overlapped with them because they found Chris, like, 24 hours before that.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the police's reasoning was. I couldn't really find. The articles were mainly about what happens after the case, so the court document was kind of the main thing for what happened leading up to that. I know I keep saying Shannon's car and people keep noticing that it's Shannon's car, but it's actually because she had two identifiable like stickers on the car. She had a North Face sticker and a Tennessee sticker. There's like some, I can't remember what it's called, but it's some big T Tennessee logo thing. I don't know if it was for the college or just the state itself, but she had those stickers on there. And so they knew when they found her car, they noticed that the stickers had been kind of pulled off or like tried to pull off. I don't know if pieces of it were stuck or you know how you can sometimes see the outline of where a sticker was. Police arrived and they investigated the car and they noticed that bags of clothes that planned on donating were missing from the back because I believe the family was still there as well and they noticed that these things were missing. They also noticed that there was caked on mud all over the backseat floorboard. They also found a pack of Newport cigarettes, like just the empty pack that was crumpled up, on the floor, but parents told authorities that the couple didn't smoke Newports. It said that they didn't smoke Newports. I don't know if that meant that they didn't smoke at all or just that that wasn't their brand, so why would they have it?
Yeah.
I don't know. So a neighbor shared that she didn't see the vehicle there when she went out to smoke around midnight, so it had to have been placed there. Actually, when did I say? Oh, I said the car was found at 1 a.m. on Monday.
Yeah.
Last time I said that was 24 hours after Chris was found. That wasn't. That was only 12 hours after Chris was
found. Okay.
So, yeah. So she went out to smoke at midnight, didn't see the car, so it had to have been placed there within the hour. Police began processing the car for fingerprints, and it was noted that the outside had been wiped clean of the prints, which insinuates that the inside was not. They were able to pull a fingerprint off of the envelope. There was an envelope, like a pay stub envelope or something like that, or a bank envelope And they found a fingerprint on it, and that led them to Davidson. After it was discovered that Davidson also lived nearby to the location that the car was discovered, because remember, he lived on Chipman.
Yeah.
Police set their sight on him as suspect number one. Tuesday afternoon, a warrant was issued, and the officers arrived at the Davidson home to begin their search. He was not home, but when Sergeant Keith DeBeau entered the kitchen, he noticed an oddly shaped trash can. It was like one of those plasticky ones.
Like, that weird description, an oddly shaped trash can.
That's why I think it's one of those, like, plastic kind of outdoor, like, gallon one. Oh, because okay. You know how it's, like, kind of flexible a little bit? Yeah. So it's obviously not standing up. There's, like, something in it. Okay. Big. So he thought someone might be hiding in it since they kind of checked the house and nobody was there. So he drew his weapon and opened the lid. Inside, he saw an arm covered in fabric, and he knew he had discovered a dead body. It says he touched the arm, so my guess is he was kind of checking for like a pulse or maybe to be like,
yeah,
hey,
hello,
come yeah. out, I caught you.
Yeah.
But he knew it was someone deceased. Shannon had, what?
Like, I'm just sorry, like, how fucking stupid is this guy? Like, why are you leaving the dead body in your house?
Oh, it gets crazier.
Like, after you've dropped the car, dropped the boy, like, Chris's body and burned him and all this shit, but yet you keep her body. Oh, I don't even want to know. Like, do I?
I know.
My mind is going to some terrible places right now.
So, before I tell you what happened and what's in the trash can, which we know is Shannon. But before I get there, I'm going to rewind again, and we're going to talk about what's been happening with Davidson.
Okay.
When all this is going on. So around 2 a.m. on Sunday, which would be like right after that guy, Xavier, saw them driving past, maybe like an hour after he saw.
Yeah.
After he saw the car. Davidson's girlfriend, Daphne, began receiving calls via, like, she was at her friend's house, and her friend's phone kept going off with an unknown number, or just, like, a number they didn't recognize, around 2 a.m. on Sunday. The police would later identify that phone number as Chris's phone number. And it was also noted that there was another random call, or another random person in Tennessee got a phone call from that number too, but he just let it go because he thought it was like spam.
Yeah.
And when they looked at the phone numbers, there was one number difference between that and the friend, so he just misdialed the number. So the calls went unanswered until later that afternoon. So the phone's ringing, Chris's phone keeps calling Davidson's girlfriend's friend all night long, and she never answers it. Also that night, a client of Davidson's remembered seeing him in a car he didn't recognize, which was Shannon's. Davidson told his client that he paid. First, he told his client, like, I don't have drugs for you. Come back later. Like, minimalism. And then when the client kind of asked about the new car, because Davidson never had a car before, like, he just got out of jail, so where the heck did he get a car? He told him he paid $2,500 for the car, but the client thought that was weird because he knew what the car was worth, or at least had an idea. Guess would be it was, like, a newer 4Runner. Even older 4Runners are still worth way more than that.
Yeah.
And so he was like, okay, that's super weird and doesn't sound legit, but I'm also buying drugs from this guy. So I'm not going to question him.
Yeah, and it's like, we're already doing some illegal activity. Where you got your car is, like, the least of his worries.
Yeah.
Like, why are you even having, like, I'm not saying that I have purchased some drugs before, but, like, you don't have, like, those aren't conversations you have with dealers.
What are you talking about? Like, Pineapple Express, when he wanted to have the conversation with Seth Rogen?
I know, they're best friends. What am I, you know, your best friends. Get in, get out. Like, here's money, here's go, bye.
I know. But also, I think it was more Davidson offering that information. I think because he was trying to avoid, like, I mean, he know he did something wrong. So he was probably trying to be like, I bought this car for $250,000 or $2,500.
$250,000. No. I'm rolling in.
So, yeah, dude, I don't know.
Too funny.
But also, I'm like, for the guy to be like, oh yeah, that car was worth way more, I'm like, yeah, but what are you gonna do? Because, like, are you questioning that the man you're buying illegal drugs from is also stealing car? Like, are you surprised at that? I don't know.
And also, yeah, and what is he gonna do, call the cops and be like, I was buying some coke and marijuana, and I noticed that this guy didn't didn't own a car and now he has this car.
And he says he paid way too little for
and,
it.
Yeah, and so it is worth so much more. Him. So I'm concerned. I'm calling as a concerned citizen. Like, all right. Definitely not happening. And if it did, okay. does, like, wow, that's pretty, yeah. pretty ballsy.
Yeah. So, anyways, like I said, that afternoon, Daphne ended up reaching out and talking to Davidson and didn't tell me who called who, but my guess is that he called her again and she finally answered. And so he kept saying, he said that he had clothes for her and so she should come back and pick them up. So he told her to wait 30 minutes before coming to the house. So naturally, her and her friend went right away because they're like, hell no, he has another girl at the house that he's trying to hide her, so we're gonna go. And I'm like, Daphne, you were doing so good, you got out of the house.
Daphne, first of all, don't fucking answer his phone calls. If you were the one that called him, why? He is an abusive piece of shit. Like, you got away. Leave. Mm-hmm. And so what if he has clothes for you? I got clothes. Thank you. I already took him out of the house. Fuck you. Like, there is no need. And also, good he's moved on. Well, not good he's moved on with somebody else because he's an abusive piece of shit. But,
Daphne, let him go. I know. So when Daphne showed up, I believe it was her and her friend. I can't remember if her friend went in the house or if just Daphne went in the house. But she tried to go into the restroom because she left her makeup bag in there. So she was like, okay, whatever. Like, I just need to get this and go. And he told her that she couldn't go into the bathroom because his brother's girlfriend, Vanessa Coleman, was in the bathroom. She's like, I don't care. I just need to grab my makeup bag and then I'm going to go. And when she tried to go, I guess there's like two doors to get into the bathroom. Like, maybe it's one of those shared things. So she tried to go the other way to get into the bathroom. And he told her no. He said, this is my house. What are you doing? Go away. Basically shoved the bag of clothes in her hand, tried to give her money. And she was like, hell no, I don't need your money. And then she took off with the clothes.
Okay.
I know. After they were back at her friend's house, they were looking at the clothes and they noticed that they were used clothes. They were older clothes. And she was like, what the heck? Like, so her friend ended up keeping the pair of jeans that were in there, but they didn't like any of the other stuff or it didn't fit. I don't know what the reasoning was, but she was like, called him and was like, come get these clothes back. Like, they're not even, like, you didn't buy these for me. And he tried to say he got them at like a thrift store. She's like, I don't care. Take them back. Like, I don't want these clothes. Which, if you remember, Shannon's car had donated clothes.
Yeah.
That. So he was just trying to get rid of evidence in this way. I'm like, just throw them away. Like, I know. Or actually go donate them.
Yeah. Just go do what Shannon was going to do.
She was going to do. I know. So Davidson ended up coming to the house to pick up the clothes, and Daphne noted that he was driving Shannon's car, but it didn't really seem like she asked questions about it. She just noted that the stickers were on the car, the North Face and the Tennessee sticker. And some other things happened. I guess he left. She ended up having to go pick him up somewhere because I believe they probably dumped the car at some point. I don't know what happened. But either way, Davidson ended up spending the night with Daphne at her friend's apartment Sunday night and Monday night. And I'm like, Daphne, I know. Come on, we're rooting for you. There's time one and two already. Like, we gotta keep going.
He gave you some used women's clothing.
No, and didn't let you get your makeup bag out of the bathroom. Anyways, so he spent the Sunday night and Monday night. He ended up staying there. And then on Tuesday afternoon, Daphne ended up receiving a phone call that woke them up. And I don't know what time it was. They said afternoon, so they were sleeping in, I guess. And it was from her mom. Her mom told her that a girl's body had been found at Davidson's house. Davidson overheard the phone call and begged Daphne to believe him that he had nothing to do with it. And it was his brother. And Daphne was like, okay, you need to get out of the house. And I don't know if she picked up his jacket or what happened, but either way, she found, or maybe she tried to grab his car key or his house keys to tell him to go. But she also found a revolver in his jacket pocket. It didn't tell me what else happened after that, but either way, she got him in her car. Daphne drove him to this other apartment complex and just left him there. And then she took off. So I'm like, good job, Daphne, for being like, you might have murdered somebody. You can stay here. So
I would be shitting my pants, like literally like freaking the fuck out if that was the phone call my mom just gave me, is that like a dead body was found at my ex-boyfriend/boyfriend or whatever the hell he is at this point. And
yeah, the dude laying next to me in bed. Yeah.
And he overheard it. Oh, so you couldn't even play it cool. Like, that's not what my mom just told me.
Like, oh, I gotta go pick up my mom to go run errand. Yeah. So
asshole's here lying beside me right now. Not a good time to talk.
Yeah.
Shit.
Also, too, before she had dropped him off, she had also started to question him because he was wearing Nikes that seemed to be too small for him. And if you recall, Chris was left barefoot. And so he insisted that he bought them for himself, which also, like, thank God he didn't kill Daphne. He had a revolver in his pocket and he didn't kill her and her friend, like, because that he was found out. So, I mean, she got super lucky. So police soon picked Davidson up at in a vacant house near the apartments that Daphne dropped him off at. Now, I'm going to go back to what happened once the police performed the autopsies. Also, too, because they didn't, because they knew that whoever, because they weren't 100% sure at the time, who was in that trash can was gone. They moved the entire trash can to the, with the medical examiner, I believe to, I would assume the morgue is where they would do the autopsy, wherever the medical examiner's office, to perform the autopsy to kind of see what's going on. So they didn't know right then and there what had happened. They found out later.
Yeah.
So just kind of a little warning that I'm going to talk about what happened. And it's obviously a murder and it's pretty intense. So if you don't want to listen, just kind of skip forward a little bit. So Shannon had been forced into a tight fetal position and had her head, neck, and shoulder twisted and pressed against her bent knees. Like, her cheek was, like, up against her knees, how she was squeezed down. She was bound in a position, into that position, with a sheer curtain, and a floral fabric similar to the one found on Chris was used to tie her thighs to her chest. A white plastic bag was placed over her head and knotted in the back to keep it in place. She was then placed in multiple black trash bags, so my guess is they just, like, wrapped her up a bunch of times, and stuffed her into the trash can still alive. They covered her with bedding and sheets and closed the lid. She suffocated due to her positioning as well as the plastic bag over her head. They said it probably would have taken about 10 minutes.
Oh, God.
And she, like, to kind of, like, pass out, I guess, and then 3 to 5 minutes to die, which is the most horrible way.
That, yeah.
Short of, like, awful. Being burned alive is, like, a terrible way to go.
Yeah.
After autopsies were performed on both of the victims, it was discovered that both of them had been sexually assaulted. Chris had been anally penetrated a few hours before his death and had significant injuries near his anal and genital area. He was shot a total of 3 times, once from a distance, and it ended up in his neck between, like, the base of his neck and his shoulder, so I guess somewhere right here. And he was shot again in his lower back, which seemed to happen as he was falling forward because it kind of grazed his spine, like, in an upward trajectory, so it kind of seemed like he was moving towards it, which caused severe spinal damage. And finally, he was shot right above his ear at close range, so the gun was at his head, at his temple, and it caused instantaneous death. All 3 bullets were still lodged in his body, and 2 of them were determined to have come from the same gun, but the last bullet was so damaged that they weren't able to confirm that it was from the same gun, but chances are that it is. Chris was set on fire with his face, head, and upper body burnt the worst, and due to the high heat, the DNA, because they did find semen inside, because of the high heat, all the DNA had been burnt away. So all they could say was that it was semen, not who it belonged to. Shannon was tortured before she died in the trash can. Her frenulum was torn, which, for anyone who doesn't know, that's the little piece of skin that connects your lip to your gums. So, like, if you separate your lip, you could feel that little piece, which, oh my God, gives me chills to think of that little piece of skin tearing.
Yeah.
And she had bruises and abrasions around his mouth that they determined to be caused by rough oral sex. I don't think they could actually determine what it was, like, or they just said an object like a penis or something else like going forcefully into her mouth. She also had tremendous injuries to her anal and genital area, and it was determined that her injuries were so bad that it was not caused by, quote, a regular rape, which breaks my heart that there's something like regular rape and something worse than that. But they said all of the injuries were caused by a blunt object coming in contact with her genital area with sufficient force, like, to cause injury. So I don't know if she was hit repeatedly or what happened, but she was for sure tortured before she died. She had bruising on her head, arms, and legs, as well as carpet burns and scratches on her back and buttocks. Davidson's DNA was found in her vagina, anus, and on her jeans, and Cobbin's DNA, which is his brother, was found in her mouth and on her camisole sweater and jeans. So that's what happened at the autopsy. Now that we're all caught up on what happened, Davidson is in police custody. So once he was arrested, he gave a lot of different stories to the police over the next few hours. So first, he claimed he wasn't at the house after Friday, so he had no idea what had happened there. But after a while, he changed it. So then he was home on Saturday. He sold some drugs. But then Daphne called him to say there was a dead body found near the train track. So he had her come pick him up. And that he wiped the prints off of the vehicle. But he didn't know the victims. And that his brother hadn't told him that Thomas had killed Chris. So that his brother's friend had killed Chris. So he's basically saying like his brother and the friend stole the car and he just happened to drive it. So then he had to clean his prints off because obviously they found a body next to the train tracks. Which I'm like, yeah, that's what all innocent people do. The next story he gave was that, okay, he was home and his brother and Thomas had taken Chris and Shannon when carjacking them and that they kidnapped them and brought them back to the house. But he said that he didn't want anything to do with it. So he left to go smoke. And when he got back, he never saw either one of them again. And then finally, the story he gave was that, okay, he did see them in the house, but he didn't have sex with her and that his DNA wouldn't be found on her, but he doesn't know who had sex with her, if anybody had sex with her. He just happened to see her there.
Yeah.
Thomas, Cobbins, and Coleman were arrested on January 11th in Lebanon, Kentucky, at a friend's house. Once arrested, they were searching the house, and it was discovered that they had been watching news coverage of the murders and, like, looking up where the police were in the investigation. And in their possession were documents and various items that had belonged to Shannon.
Hey, ding dong, like, yet again. Like, well, I mean, there is enough to convict these people anyway, but...
But yeah, if you commit a murder, don't start Googling the murder.
People gotta insert themselves. They have to know. It would be hard. But it would be hard not to look it up. Come on, like... To look it up. You know?
Yeah.
Like, okay, what's going on? Am I in the clear? Do they think it's somebody else? Like, I can see. Yeah.
So... On January 31st, 2007, Davidson, Thomas, Cobbins, and Coleman were charged. Thomas, Davidson, and Cobbins all faced the same 46 charges, and they were 16 counts of felony murder related to the rape, robbery, kidnapping, and theft of both Shannon and Chris, 2 counts of premeditated murder, 2 counts of of especially aggravated robbery, which I don't know what the especially has to do with it, but I added it in there. 4 counts of especially aggravated kidnapping, 20 counts of aggravated rape, and 2 counts of theft. Coleman faced 40 counts, which included 12 counts of felony murder related to the rape, robbery, kidnapping, and theft of Shannon and Chris. 1 count of premeditated murder of Shannon only. 1 count of especially aggravated robbery of Chris only, 4 counts of especially aggravated kidnapping, and 20 counts of aggravated rape, and 2 counts of theft. So she just had slightly different charges because she was only charged in certain situations. Boyd was arrested in connection with the carjacking, and all the trials took place separately throughout the summer of 2008. On April 16th, 2008, Boyd was found guilty of being an accessory to a fatal carjacking and for failing to report the location of a known fugitive because I believe he was the one who was hiding Davidson out in that abandoned house. He was sentenced to 18 years in federal prison. On August 25th, 2009, Cobbins was found guilty of first-degree felony murder in the case of Chris, guilty of facilitation of murder for Shannon, but was acquitted of her rape. He was sentenced to life without parole the very next day. This is Cobbins? Yeah, the brother.
Wasn't his DNA found in her mouth?
Yep.
What?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was sentenced to life without parole the very next day. Davidson was found guilty, it sounded like, on pretty much all counts. And the jury unanimously voted on the death penalty on the four capital charges of murder. So June 2010, he was sentenced to 80 years for other charges related to the murder to be served consecutively to the two death penalties, which were also consecutive. So he has two death penalties plus 80 years, which, oh my God, the law doesn't make sense.
I know. But okay.
But hey, that's cool. On December 8th, 2009, Thomas was found guilty on multiple counts and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole on the four capital convictions, which I believe are just the murders. Coleman was granted immunity for testimony in the federal case of the carjacking, but the state courts decided that her immunity could not extend to the charges of murder and rape. It would just keep her immune, I think, for like the carjacking and some of the death and stuff. I don't know. She was acquitted of first-degree murder on May 13th, 2010, but found guilty on the lesser charges. On July 30th, 2010, she was sentenced to 53 years. All of these convictions were appealed, of course.
Of course.
But only Coleman and Thomas were granted retrials. And I'm not going to get into it too much, but if you want to read into it, feel free. But there was some drama in all of the appeals because I guess the judge for some of these cases, or the judge trying to determine who gets the retrials or things like that, turns out he was buying drugs from, like, criminals, like, convicted people. And so he got busted.
I thought you were going to say that he bought drugs from Davidson.
No. I don't think it had anything to do with that. Okay. Just that he had using and he was buying drugs. And so he had to recuse himself. Mm-hmm. And there was a bunch of drama as to, like, oopsie, he was doing that. So that means we got to all redo them all. Yeah. And they were like, no. We're just redoing these ones. Coleman was convicted on lesser charges, and she was sentenced to 35 years on February 1st, 2013, minus the credit for time already served. Her parole, it says her parole was blocked by a judge in 2019, but another article I read said she wouldn't be eligible until 2020 for parole. So I couldn't find anything that said where she was currently. I believe she's still in prison.
Yeah, maybe she had her parole hearing in 2019 for a release date of 2020.
Yeah, but she didn't get it. On May 17th, 2013, Thomas was found guilty on all counts with a lesser charge on one of them. He was resentenced to life in prison, but with the possibility of parole in 51 years. In January 2016, Thomas appealed to the United States Supreme Court, but they did not agree to hear his case. On March 20th, 2018, Knox County's grand jury returned a 36-count indictment charging Boyd with first-degree felony murder. Because remember, Boyd, I didn't mention him too much, but he went with Davidson to carjack, and he was the one that, like, held the gun and, like, got them in the car. So he definitely had something to do with it.
Yeah.
They charged him with first-degree felony murder, first-degree premeditated murder, especially aggravated robbery, especially aggravated kidnapping, and aggravated rape in the murders. Also, too, I believe it was Thomas and Cobbins, or maybe Davidson. Somehow, some of them turned on Boyd and tried to say that Boyd did it and that he killed Chris and that they had no idea about that, to, of course, try to help their own
Of course. Things.
So he went on trial on the state charges in August of 2019 and was found guilty on nearly all of them. He was then sentenced to life in prison. So all of them are locked up and all of them are still serving their time. I believe a couple of them might be in the same prison, but I think they kind of spread them out a little bit. And so there was definitely some media backlash on the case, because people were pissed that it wasn't tried as a hate crime because Shannon and Chris were white and all of the men and Coleman, they were all black. And so Chris's mother stated that if this wasn't a hate crime, then I don't know how you would define a hate crime. It may have started out as a carjacking, but what it developed into was blacks hating whites. To do the thing that they did, they would have to hate them to do it.
What?
I know. And Shannon's dad only stated, and not in response to Chris's mom, but just like to people who are using, because Fox News picked it up and there was stuff on social media.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he basically told anybody who was using his daughter's murder to push their own agenda that the crime isn't about you. And so leave her out of it. Like, it has nothing to do with you. Like,
Go Shannon's dad. Good.
I know. In 2007, white supremacists rallied in downtown Knoxville to protest, but were met with counter-protesters. People were quick to call out the Black Lives Matter movement and its supporters because they kind of used that as, like, they showed a picture of it. It was, like, a meme that went around where it showed Shannon and Chris, and then it showed all of their mugshots. And so it was, like, where's the media outrage? And then, in addition, like, on the side with all the mugshots, it described, like, they cut off his penis and they burned him alive and they stuffed her in a chair. And it kind of, like, just made up all these crazy things about dismemberment and all of this torture and it was a hate crime and all of this stuff. And it's none of that happened. And one, why do you feel like you have to make the murder worse? Like, it's already terrible. But also, like, just, and I know we've talked about it a bunch of times, but Black Lives Matter isn't saying that there aren't, or that they're, like, injustice, it's going to fight every injustice. It's saying that injustices tend to happen to African American people more often by the very people that are supposed to protect them, and they get away with it. These people who are supposed to protect them get away with it. Whereas in this instance, they were all caught almost immediately, and they're all in jail.
Yeah.
Is it a terrible crime? Yes. And it's awful. But there's not, they received some justice here because the people who did it didn't get away with it. They weren't put on paid administrative leave and just told to get another job. Like, no.
No. And and to, like, go with hate crime, like, you have to specifically know that all of them had issues with white people and specifically picked out Chris and Shannon because they were white, where it sounds like it's a little bit more of an opportunity issue here. And
yeah, so, they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Exactly.
Also, too, Daphne, I believe, was white.
I was just going to ask that because Daphne is a very white girl name. Not saying that there couldn't be any other ethnicities named Daphne, but Daphne is a very white girl name. And so I was just going to ask, is Daphne white? Because, like, then, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, not saying.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no. And, I mean, there can be hate crimes against white people. There can. It could be racially motivated. It totally can happen. But it doesn't sound like in this case that was the specifics. And as we've talked about in other cases where hate crime came up and they couldn't put it on the books and charge them with it, because you can't just assume because you're two different races that it's race has the key element in the murder or the crime.
Yeah. And hate crimes are very hard to prove in some instances because you really, like you said, that has to be the sole motivation for this. And he never said, oh, let's go find us some crackers and steal their car. No, he said, let's go carjack some people because I need a car. Let's go get my life back.
I was trying to figure out, like, what the motivation, because this, like, went from zero to crazy real quick. Yeah. From just stealing somebody's car to torture, rape, torture, and murder, like, is very...
Yeah, well, with Davidson, remember, he was just getting more and more pissed. Yeah. Daphne had left him, and she wasn't, like, seeming to... he stayed over, but she kind of turned on him. Like, she was getting there. Like, that was after he murdered everybody. But, like, I think it was just he was so pissed. And then who knows what the influence of the other people had on him, like, his... Mm-hmm. Like I said, his brother and the friend, like, they weren't working. They were just on the couch. Like, they were all selling drugs.
It was a perfect storm.
My guess would be that they were doing them because Davidson was doing drugs. So they could have been all, like, high,
knows?
Coked out of their mind.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know. But also, too, like, okay, so they stole the car. Maybe they just happened to get them in the car. We don't know anything but their side of the story.
So yep.
I don't know if Chris or Shannon fought back or said something. Like, not saying it's their fault, but maybe they said something to try to get them away from them and they yeah. got pissed and like threw them in the car. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, or and Davidson has, I guess, a past of abuse, so.
Yeah, and aggravated robbery. Before. So maybe yeah. they thought, like, oh, let's take them back here and we'll do whatever. And maybe it just escalated to murder. Yeah. It got to that point. Like, yeah. Not it was the same. I told, was it Wichita? The massacre where the friends, I believe it was Kansas. I think it was Kansas. My story from Kansas, where the group of friends brothers? Were at the house.
Oh.
Yes. Uh-huh. I'm pretty sure that was Kansas.
But yeah.
Yeah, with the Carr brothers, is that all of a sudden they were just, like, on this spree and trying to, and they were breaking in and robbing, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden it turned into this weird, like, they kept taking turns raping everybody. And
yeah.
It yeah. just escalated. So, I don't know. There's no, I don't know if we'll ever have an answer as to why it escalated that way, but it's really unfortunate that it did. And it's unfortunate, too. Like, they were both very young, 21 and 23, mm-hmm. and they were just living their life. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, also, too, like, their friends must feel terrible for not being like, oh, no, come with me. He can meet you there. Or like, oh, yeah. no, just stay at the party. Like, I mean, again, not saying it's their fault, but that's also, like, I feel like that would be the thoughts going through my head, right?
Oh, it's yeah, like, some survivor guilt.
Yeah, or why didn't I stay at the house mm-hmm. with her? Or, like, we all go together.
Yeah.
Or, you know what I mean?
So many things we could have done. But mm-hmm. you can't ever, nobody anticipates something like this. Like, this is just yeah. murder of opportunity, sadly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did read that after everything, even though the media tried to kind of use them, which I hate that the media tries to like pit races against each other like that. But after all of that, they did start a scholarship fund in honor of Chris. Like it was, or I believe it was in honor of Chris. And then they had a separate one in honor of Shannon at the different schools that they attended. Mm-hmm. And then for Chris, they had for 2 years, I think 2008 and 2009, they had like a little league game in his honor. And then, so they had some stuff to remember them from, because he was from Knoxville. And so, yeah, so I thought that was very nice. Like a way to honor them is to offering these scholarships to help people. I believe hers was, might have been tied from like the high school to get to the college. And then his was something to do with the little league. And then they offered a scholarship mm-hmm. with that as well. So. Yeah, it was just really unfortunate. They seem like really nice people, and yeah, it was just wrong place, wrong time, and yeah. that sucks.
Yeah, that's such a, I think that that's one of the things that a lot of people like about, well, not like, but are so interested in true crime is because it's like, a lot of these stories are not that these people instigated themselves or put themselves in situations where murder was inevitable, but like they're just living mm-hmm. their lives and something catches up to them that is totally unexpected and unseen in the shadows, and all of a sudden here it is, and this is what they did or dealt. And that's what's
yeah.
such a scary thing is that, and as we travel the country, it's like we're seeing this in all different places, so it's like it can happen anywhere, big city, small towns. And so that I think is the key part, is like, holy shit, this could happen anywhere and you'd never know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, I remember plenty of time walking from my apartment into the parking lot by myself mm-hmm. or with a friend because we're getting ready to go late at night and go somewhere. Like, I mean, I think we've all been there where we've been walking mm-hmm. alone to our car or alone oh, somewhere. Yeah. And
I mean, oh, yeah. When I worked at,
yeah.
I saw working at Starbucks, at one of the Starbucks I worked at, 4 different carjackings. Like in the time I worked there, and I worked there in that place for 2.5 years, and I saw 4 different carjackings, like just in my shifts. And so it was like, oh shit. Gosh. Yeah. And the Panda Express next door was robbed by gunpoint. And like, there's just like all these things in here, like, oh my gosh. Yeah. So like that can happen anywhere, carjacking or, but yeah, just that's so crazy that it went from trying to steal your car to that. Just as crazy.
All right. And now it's time for our super fun state facts.
And cities.
All right. I can't remember who's... You started with Alabama or did I start with Alabama? I can't remember.
I don't know. Why don't you go ahead and start, because I have the state fact this week.
All right. So, My fun fact for Knoxville, Tennessee, was that it is known as the streaking capital of the world.
Like streaking like nude people? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because back in 1974, a number of University of Tennessee students and a few others decided to bear not just their souls, but their bodies as well. So the streaking craze hit Knoxville, and Walter Cronkite had designated Knoxville as the streaking capital of the world because in the spring of that year, an estimated 5,000 people on Cumberland Avenue took their clothes off stripping on the strip. And so there's like a newspaper article like I've been running through. And so, yes, it kind of went crazy and there was like a bunch of stuff going on. Like, I guess like there are people were joking around and like simulating sex acts on like this bull that was on the roof of a popular hangout. Some couples even had sex on the sidewalk, it says. So, like, people went crazy. But, yeah, so it was crazy. And so the University of Tennessee chancellor at the time, Jack Reese, and the police chief, Joe Fowler, vowed to not to tolerate any further stunts and blame the uproar on, like, media hyping up the streaking that was happening.
Yeah.
And I guess there was even, like, a song by Ray Stevens. It was called The Streak, and it helped popularize the trend of it. And, like, other bars on the strip offered beer to any female streakers brave enough to claim it. So it just became this huge thing. And so Knoxville, Tennessee is the streaking capital of the world.
Interesting. My college, when I was in Kansas, has a history of streaking. So nice. They have a thing called Fall Fest. It's like their homecoming week. And students always, and like it's also parent weekend. And some people always, well, when I don't know if they still do it. This was 20 years ago. Would always like streak past like all the parents and everything during, it was pretty funny. I never did it, but. But I know a number of people who did. So, hey.
Nice. Be nude. I've never been streaking. I don't plan to.
No, me either.
Go streaking.
I've been skinny dipping, so what is, but not streaking.
Oh, look at you all adventurous. I've never done that either. All right. So what is your city fact?
Okay. So my murder took place in Ridgetop, which of course is a small town next to, like, by Nashville. And so all I could find about, like, Ridgetop was, like, its demographics. So, like, that there's 52% women and, like, 48% men. So that's not very interesting. So I'm going to actually cover Nashville, as a lot of my story took place in Nashville. And so, and I'm specifically going to talk to you guys about the Ryman Theater, which was built in the 1800s to house tent revivals. So it was like an indoor tent revival. So, you know, like the praise Jesus, lay hands, that kind of shit. Mm-hmm. Not shit. Yeah, if you praise Jesus, it's fine. But like, you know,
that
like
this, kind.
Yeah, like the, yeah, like the heal me kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Where the people walk from the wheelchairs and they speak, yes, in tongues and all, yeah, that crazy stuff.
So there's a Simpsons episode where Bart becomes one of those evangelical, like, praise preachers and is healing people. There's also a Simpsons episode where Bart goes to Knoxville, Tennessee, and they go see the sun sphere. I can always attribute anything to the Simpsons. Anyway, so that's what it was built for. However, it became home of the Grand Old Opry for a number of years. But it is also known as one of the most haunted places in America. So you can do some haunted tours there. So the ghosts that are reported to be there, first a lot of people report seeing a white mist. And then apparently the ghost of Hank Williams Sr. is reported to haunt the Opry. There is a gray man who shows up during rehearsals. And then the original owner, Thomas Ryman, lets his displeasure be known if he doesn't approve of the act on stage. So he makes loud noises and like causes like havoc if like he deems the act too risque.
Interesting.
So if you're in Nashville, the Ryman is definitely a historical place that you would probably want to visit. I know they still do a number of shows there. It was kind of remodeled. Well, not remodeled, but kind of, it was disrepair in the like 80s and 90s. And now it's been revamped and there's a lot of like country singers that perform there. But you can also go try to check out and see if you can see the Ghosties.
Nice. Sounds like fun.
Yeah. So, and then I also read that Nashville somewhere, or I heard this one time that Nashville is now the bachelorette capital of the United States. So people, women go for bachelorette parties.
Go
yeah.
there.
So apparently that's a big thing.
Yeah.
So, and then I have this super fun state fact for Tennessee. And it's, I don't know if it's uplifting, but it's a little weird. and since we talk about murder, Tennessee is probably, I'm just going to go ahead and say it, the only only place in the world that has hung an elephant for murder. So I'm sure that there are some that have been put down, but hung. So here's the story.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know. So Mary the elephant was a 5-ton Asian elephant, also known as Murderous Mary. She performed in the Sparks World Famous Shows Circus. After killing her trainer, she ended up being hung in 1916. Her death is sometimes interpreted as a cautionary tale of circus animal abuse during the early 20th century. So, poor Mary. Stupid trainer. Job isn't to entertain you people. I freaking hate that. That's the kind of, I hate that. That's why, I mean, I know I have issues with zoos. I definitely hate circuses. Like, just the blatant abuse of animals. And, like, I was just watching.
Although, not all zoos. Because zoos are, like, they're sanctuary. Like, they help.
Yeah. But when you go to a zoo and it's, like, this small pen and they're just pacing back and forth, it's so awful. And then I was watching, I don't know why on my Facebook feed, but sometimes Monica, the singer Monica, comes, like, her, like, little Facebook live posts, I don't know, whatever the heck you call them. I don't know why sometimes it's on my Facebook, but she had one where she was like sitting with her like kid and they had like two baby tigers in a swimming pool that they were playing with. And I just totally disagree. And I know like Tiger King was a thing and everything. I just do not agree with that kind of like just abuse of animals. And I don't like that. But definitely like riding of elephants and like circuses, it just puts a distaste in my mouth. So
yeah, not a fan of the circus.
And an elephant was just, she was just doing what elephants do. And this guy got in her way. So fuck that trainer. You know, I'm like,
I know.
So,
not he probably very deserved it. He had it coming. Yeah. No, that was Chicago. We're past that.
Although you and I were, when we were talking about our fun fact, we were talking about how it made us think of Topsy with Thomas Edison and the Bob's Burger episode. One of the best episodes of Bob's Burger, in my opinion.
Electric love.
Oh, Topsy.
Oh, poor Topsy the elephant. And for anyone who doesn't know, Topsy the elephant was electrocuted by Thomas Edison because he was trying to talk about how currents were safer because he was fighting against Tesla,
DC.
Right?
Yeah, Tesla and DC currents, I think.
So he was trying to prove that his were safer and he killed an elephant named Topsy.
Poor Topsy the elephant.
I know.
Nothing like two elephant murders to end a podcast.
To really end the episode. Sorry, Tennessee. Also, too, sorry, before we get to all the closing cleaning house stuff, I recently heard, and I'm very disappointed in you, South Dakota, because we used it as a fun fact, but the Sturgis bike... Oh. What was it? The bike rally or whatever that was? The bike festival?
Yeah.
Still took place, even though COVID is very much still a thing. And now hundreds of cases of COVID that are new are being linked to that event. So,
a Germany company guessed that it would be 250,000 cases will be linked to Sturgis.
Yeah. So I'm very disappointed in you, South Dakota, just so you know. And...
Let's be disappointed in the South in South Dakota's governor, who has done jack all when it comes to COVID. So fuck her.
Yep. So if you live in South Dakota, very sorry. Hopefully you didn't go to that event, and hopefully, I'm sure if you're still around listening to our podcast, you're probably similar viewed, but yeah, so that really sucks. I'm really sad that we used that as our fun fact, because it was such a fun event and they ruined it because now they're spreading a bunch of COVID in South Dakota and wherever else those people came from.
Yep, all over the country.
Mm-hmm. So, boo on you.
Yep.
All right. Now, thank you guys so much for listening to this episode again. Thank you for helping us get to 2,000 listens. You guys are amazing. We are still continuing to do our shout outs. So if you have registered to vote, if you have completed your census, email us, message us, however you want to get in touch with us. If you know us personally, shoot us a text and we will gladly shout you out in the beginning of the episode. Keep in mind, you still have a few weeks to fill out the census. It is due by September 30th. If you haven't done it already, it takes less than 5 minutes, and it is very important to make sure that everybody is counted. They can't use any of your personal information. It's just to make sure that funding goes where it needs to go. So if you care about your tax dollars going towards things that could benefit you in the next 10 years, fill out the census. Yeah, so next week, we will be moving on up to Kentucky, and we will be sharing two brand new cases there. So make sure you like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at SOM Podcast to stay up to date with any things that we have, especially as we approach this holiday season. We might throw a few bonus episodes your way, so you want to be notified the second those drop. So make sure you follow us there. As always, check out our website, www.stateofmurder.com, for any bonus content where you can find a picture of String Bean. And so make sure you check that out. And yeah, if you have any corrections, updates, cases you want us to cover as we reach the East Coast, please feel free to email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you guys. And I think that's it. So we'll see you next week in Kentucky. Bye. Bye.